Today's guest says the United States was founded on hate, the hatred that justified annihilation of American Indians and that perpetuated the enslavement of Africans. These are somber and sobering words indeed. But today she is here to talk about something that is the opposite of hate, a refreshing concept in today's complicated world. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. For many, today's guest is a known quantity, Sally Cohn, journalist, author, CNN commentary, Fox News commentary, commentator, TED Talk regular. And again, today she's talking about her book, The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. Sally Cohn, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
As you heard me say a moment ago, the idea that we could talk about something that is indeed the opposite of hate in today's world is refreshing. It's almost a relief from so much of the vitriolic chatter we hear. Why write The Opposite of Hate?
Well, you know, I think, I hope we can all agree that hate is a problem in our world, you know, not hating broccoli, not hating certain music or certain movies, but the history we have in the past and the habits we have in the present of demeaning and dehumanizing certain people, especially certain groups of people, because of either their identity or their ideas, that endemic, systemic, pervasive kind of hate that really shapes inequality and injustice in our world and all around us. And, you know, what I came to realize is that hate, fortunately, tends to be something that we all say we're against. We all tend to think it's a problem. And yet, the weird thing about it as a phenomenon is that we all tend to agree it's a problem, but none of us think it's our problem. Literally no one thinks it's their problem, whatever side you're on. And so we have this crisis of hate that everybody is upset about, but no one actually thinks is their fault. And so no one is doing anything to solve. And what I realize is that we all need to take responsibility for our part of it. That includes each and every one of us.
You said early on in The Opposite of Hate that you were trained to hate, that you worked as a community organizer. And, you know, we hear a lot of things about community organizers, but that they are trained to hate, I don't know if that's really how we think about that. Say a little bit more about that.
You know, yeah, I mean, trained to hate is maybe a more extreme version of it, but, you know, a good organizer is, and there's a sort of school and philosophy of organizing that's very much about opposition and antagonism. And, you know, polarizing an issue and personalizing that issue and picking a target and not only, you know, making clear that target is the opposition, but, you know, demonizing, attacking that target, even at a personal level, that is not all organizers, not all activists, but that there certainly is a school and practice of that kind of intense, aggressive, even mean tactics in all sides of politics and activism, and to be honest, and that I had never really given it much thought. You know, I'd, in particular, sort of growing up working on LGBT rights and immigrant rights in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, and you know, my political opponents were the right wing, and I thought of them as hateful, and as their, you know, not just their views, not just their positions, not just their actions, but them as people. And without really thinking much about it, I hated them. And the contradiction, the hypocrisy in that never for a moment occurred to me, that here I was thinking I was justified in hating people because they were hateful and that somehow my hate would be the antidote to their hate. It never dawned on me until it did.
Well, you know, you talk about being in opposition to the quote-unquote right wing. So you need to help us understand your Fox News experiences.
Yeah, it was really when I kind of fell into the media from my world of organizing and ended up working as a, you know, lefty lesbian on air at Fox News, that I came face to face with the people who I had these generalizations and really stereotypes about. Again, not just that they believed or supported hateful ideas, which still, by the way, I think is true, but that I generalized that to then think that these were entirely, completely, totally hateful people, nothing but hate, defined them by their worst beliefs or worst actions. And so when I got to Fox and found out that the people on air, off air, viewers were in fact complicated, sometimes kind, sometimes cruel, often caring people who were supportive of me, my family, my career, my life, and that were not the generalizations I had imagined them to be, the worst case scenarios I had portrayed them in my mind, that really threw me for a loop. Maybe it shouldn't have, but, you know, I'm not proud of it, but it did. And it really led me to realize, oh, I've been hating them all this time. And that's, you know, partly about them and their positions, but it's also about me. And it's also about this sort of culture of hate and otherizing and polarization that we have. And I, look, it's not, we could debate who does it worse and who does it first, but I do a piece of it. And if I'm against hate, I should do something about my own.
So starting at home with taking a long, hard look at who and what you are as an individual, where you take your thoughts, your attitudes, your own personal prejudices, is really a way to begin to fight not only your own hatred, but to really become an advocate for fighting the hatred of others.
That's right. I mean, you know, I talk in the book about a pyramid of hate.
Yes.
And so we want to be careful not to suggest that all kinds of hate are the same. Of course they're not. Of course there's no comparison, you know, between being a bully or writing nasty things online and being a neo-Nazi and participating in genocide. It's ridiculous to equate those things. And we can also recognize that the core of dehumanization, the habit of demeaning and dehumanizing people that is in part rooted in our history, the fact that the people most likely to be bullied in schools, the people most likely to be targets of hate online, are the same groups of people most likely to be the victims of neo-Nazi hate groups and genocide, suggests that there is, in fact, a common threat. That the history we have in the past and the habits we have in the present of demeaning and dehumanizing certain groups of people because of who they are or what they believe. We all do it. It tends to be done worse to certain groups of people based on that history and the way it still plays out today. And so, again, recognizing that, look, the truth is life is complicated and we all tend to find ourselves on both sides of that equation. You talk to most people, even people you wouldn't expect, people you'd think, oh, well, these are, you know, members of hate groups or whatever. You talk to most people and most people in some way, shape or form have seen or do see themselves as victims of hate. That there is some group of people who they feel unjustly hate them and treat them unfairly because of that hate. At the same time, we're all on the other side of that equation too, in some way, shape, or form. There is some group of people that we treat as less than, less equal than us, less deserving, The problem is when we only focus on how we are hated and not how we are doing the hating. If we only all focus on how we are on the receiving side, then we're never actually addressing the perpetration and perpetuation of hate. And so what we really have to do is, you know, recognize that duality and take responsibility for ourselves.
Now, you know that there are people who feel or report that they feel energized by the hate. They feel empowered, emboldened. In fact, there are those who would say that they didn't just start hating yesterday. They've been hating fill in the blanks for a long time, but now it's okay. Now it's American. Now it's free speech. What do you say to those people? Maybe they don't want to think about the opposite of hate. Maybe hate is, as I said, good. It's energizing. What do you say to them?
That's nothing new. That's nothing. First of all, that's nothing new in the traditions and history of the United States and of the world. As you started out by saying, by pointing out, look, it's the simple fact is that the United States, in spite of our very lofty and admirable ideals to the contrary, is a country that was founded in hate. That was the, you know, land that became the United States of America was cleared through an act of genocide against Native people. And then the nation was built through the enslavement of African people. And at most steps along the way since has actively tried to deny basic rights and equality to group after group after group. And so, you know, and in fact, often has defined our identity in some sort of opposition to or otherization of some group or nation or continent or kind of people. And, you know, that is unfortunately a part of human tradition in general, right? That we, it's very interesting to, you know, one of the things that struck me the most in researching the book was both the anecdotal stories I heard from the ex-neo-Nazis and ex-terrorists and people I interviewed for the book, but also the research on this suggests that even these folks who you'd think, well, of course, I mean, they're actively and enthusiastically embracing hate, right? They tend to not see themselves as hateful either. They tend to see their motivations as good. And in fact, the research suggests that people don't join these sort of extremist hate groups because of the ideology of hate, but rather that they are seeking belonging. They find belonging in these groups, and the term the researchers use is that they slide into the ideology. They deepen their ideology of hate as a kind of bonding. And the sad reality is that that's what we tend to do. And certain forms of it, you're right, are more socially acceptable at certain moments more than others. But it's an unfortunate reality. Look, that's what modern politics has been. Both sides have done it in the United States, but one party more than the other has mobilized hate and mobilized resentment against certain groups of people as a way of bonding voters to candidates in a party.
Indeed. And Sally, we're going to take a break.
Please.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll pick up right here. Folks, talking to Sally Cohn, the author of The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. You're listening to Mind Talk. I'm Pamela Brewer. Stay right where you are. We will be back in just a moment. Sally Callie, you were talking about the ways in which people sort of slide into ways of hating and methods of hating as a way to
Yes.
bond with other groups, and oddly enough, to then feel loved by the group they're bonding with.
Yes. You know, it's just, and we think that's so alien and we think that's so terrible, but the fact is we sort of all do it, even if we're bonding against, you know, look, to use a personal example, after the 2016 election, I found myself in, you know, liberal circle after liberal circle and dinners and parties, and we're could be sitting around talking about, oh, you know, those Trump voters, they're so racist, they're so Islamophobic, they're so anti-immigrant, they're so hateful, and I hate them. And in a way, we'd be sitting there bonding over how much we hate these hateful people.
It's interesting.
Not noticing that, of course, hate is not the antidote to hate, just like injustice is not the antidote to injustice, and you know, more inequality is not the answer to inequality.
You talk about the ABCs as a way to think about changing around your dialogue. What are the ABCs?
So ABC is a technique that was taught to me by Matt Kohut, John Neffinger, and Seth Pendleton. Matt and John wrote a really great book for folks who are interested in understanding this further called Compelling People. And it's a strategy for, look, what we know is that when people have arguments, right, somebody raises an issue of an opinion with us and we argue with them, you know, if our goal is to actually, like, we disagree, I disagree with your position on, you name it, immigration reform, climate policy, trade, our instinct is to argue. What happens when we argue is that the reasoning persuasion parts of our brain shut down, and the fight or flight lizard brain turns on, and you pick a side. You tend to pick the side you started on. You're no longer open to being persuaded. So the key to persuasion is actually to keep that frontal part of the brain engaged and to have a conversation, keep it conversational and engaging. And the strategy for doing that is this ABC method, so that when someone says something you disagree with or challenges a position you have or a deeply held belief, that instead of jumping right to arguing, which shuts down the discussion, instead to listen. And the A in ABC is to affirm, to find something, not to agree, but to find something in their position, usually the reason for their position, the feelings underneath their beliefs, that you can understand, that you can validate, even if you don't agree with it. Because people don't want to be told that their feelings are invalid, that their fears, their hopes, their concerns, their dreams, they don't want to be told they're invalid. And so the key is first, the A is affirm, find something, usually a feeling, that you can validate. The B is a bridge. It's not but. When you say but, it means everything that came before. I just spoke to you, you know, everything in the beginning of the sentence, actually, I didn't mean at all. So it's not, but it's bridge. It's, and that's why, or just, and, or, you know, it's something that gets you to then the C, which is the point you wanted to make, your thought, your original argument, but now you're making it in the context of a conversation, in the context of being persuasive.
I note that you say that the word however is the Harvard of buts.
Yeah, no fancy buts. No fancy buts.
And as give us an example. You gave some examples about conversations with Aunt Lucy. Give us an example of affirming and give us an example of the bridge before we go on to see.
Let's see. So let's say someone, you know, says, look, I don't, I feel badly for these kids, these immigrant kids and their families, and, you know, they want a better life. And I get that. It's just that I, you know, they're coming here and taking our jobs. and we don't have jobs to get for something like that.
Okay.
Now, the immediate, my immediate instinct is to say, actually, that's not true. Here's the data. Your conclusion is wrong. Because, in fact, by the way, factually it is. But that is not going to lead to persuasion. That's not going to lead to the kind of conversation that leads to change. It's actually just going to make people dig in their heels to be argued with. And instead, under this ABC approach, the way to think about that is instead to think about the feeling that's underneath that conclusion. The feeling underneath that conclusion is really about economic fear and insecurity. That there aren't enough jobs, that the economy is unstable, that it's a really crappy time to try to make ends meet. And that's true, by the way. It is true. And I happen to, I don't even just have to validate that. I can appreciate that. And so I could start by saying, you know, it's true that is a really hard time for anyone in this economy and anyone trying to make ends meet and feed a family and, you know, pay the bills and wages are going down. Right? Like, I guess, yeah, that is true. And that's exactly why we need to make sure that everyone who is working in this economy is out of the shadows, and so that, you know, those crummy employers can't find workers they take advantage of and end up screwing us all. Right? That's the conversation we want to be having.
So that's a really interesting, smooth shift. You've taken me from all these immigrants are terrible people to, oh yeah, the economy and employers and wages. Oh yeah, I get that. Very clever,
it's
Sally Cohn.
People with your most, I think it's listening to people with your most generous mind.
Okay.
And your most generous heart.
And what is the C of ABC?
That's the convince. That's what you actually came to say. That's where I would say, look, that's why we need comprehensive immigration reform, because it allows everyone in the country working, all of whom our economy relies on to be, you know, supported at the same level, and that employers can't take advantage and pit some of us against others. And, you know, that's the argument I wanted to make right off the bat. And maybe it's where I would say the data about how, actually, you know, study after study shows that folks are coming here to do jobs that United States citizens don't want to do, and it's a really, you know, that we need all levels of workers in an economy, and you know, that's where I might talk about the history of migration. That's where I would go to my actual argument, but it's instead I've had the conversation in a way that people can hopefully hear, as opposed to shut down.
Who would you say the opposite of hate is for? Is it for everyone?
Well, I hope it's for everyone. you know, I really wrote it, I think, especially for sort of well-meaning, kind of center-of-the-road liberal folks who may think themselves well-meaning when they contrast them, you know, in contrast to the extremists on the right, but often don't think about how they've got more work to do too. So you're not the, you know, extremist, you know, neo-Nazi. Great, thank you. Wonderful, important, fantastic. And you still got some unconscious racial bias to notice and work on. You still, you know, have your way of seeing, you know, without thinking about it, viewing immigrant kids as less human, less deserving than your own kids. We all still have, and so you haven't reached the finish line of work to be done on yourself.
You know, in so many ways, what you're saying is clearly powerful. I kind of wish that you would go back in and do a book for kids, with the same themes, but just written for the younger set. It would be, in my humble view, very powerful, very useful.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's funny. My daughter really, really, really wants to write a children's book with me and was very disappointed that she could not do the illustrations in my book. She was also very disappointed when she found out there was no illustrations in my book. So it's certainly something. Thank you. That's great. That's a great idea.
Well, I would like to be among the first to have you back when you and your little one write The Opposite of Hate for the younger set. Sally Cohn, author of The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. Sally, what's your web address?
It is SallyCohn, KOHN.com.
Terrific. Thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me and for all that you do.
Thank you, Sally. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand. Just a reminder, today's guest, Sally Cohn, that's SallyKohn. The website is SallyCohn.com. There's lots of information there about what Sally is doing. And again, we were talking about The Opposite of Hate. And isn't that something that would be useful and energizing for all of us, I would suggest? You can also download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you are listening today. So do send an email to me at pamela@mindtalk.org. That's P-A-M-E-L-A @mindtalk.org. I'd love to also hear your comments or questions about this or any Mind Talk program. So once again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care. We'll be right back.